Circuit Court of Appeals. We have two cases to be submitted today on oral argument, beginning with United States versus Trotter. Mr. Hester.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. In this case, the government plainly breached its promise to Mr. Trotter to recommend a guideline sentence. Plain error review applies, and this error was clear and obvious because there are a number of very clear, obvious, really aggressive attacks on the guideline range that the government agreed to in this case.
But the sentence was within the guideline at the top.
It was, Your Honor, and Kirkland is an example of a case where the court didn't follow the government's recommendation after it breached the agreement, the plea agreement, yet this court still reversed on plain error review. In Kirkland, the court sentenced in the middle of the guidelines, even though the government was breaching the plea agreement and asking for top of the guidelines. So even though the court didn't do what the government was asking in Kirkland, it was still plain error reversal. So I think that is a case we're relying on heavily today.
Is it your view that if we agree with you on that issue, that this must be assigned to a different district judge?
Your Honor, as in Williams, which we cite in the conclusion section of our brief, we're requesting that this court vacate the judgment, remand to the district court, and then Mr. Trotter will make a counsel decision with his trial counsel on whether he gets specific performance of the plea agreement in front of a new judge or elects to just withdraw from the plea agreement altogether. That's exactly what the court did.
Well, when you say specific performance, that's as between the defendant and the government. You can't bind the court.
Right. So what he bargained for here and what we're saying the government obviously breached was for a guideline recommendation from the government. And you can't make a guideline recommendation and then call the guidelines a myopic bubble that's tunnel vision, that is out of step with the public's view on these cases, and then say that they significantly underrepresent the severity of the conduct, which the government said on page 418 of the record. So those are clear, obvious breaches of the government's promise to Mr. Trotter that Mr. Trotter bargained for and gave up all of his important trial rights. And a reading of Kirkland and Malmquist, you'll find a lot of poignant commentary on the value of that promise. Those cases talk about how important the government's recommendation is to courts at sentencing. And when the government makes these promises, how fundamental it is to the system, and this is really getting into prong four and prong three of plain error review, but how fundamental these agreements are to the system where 98% of defendants plead guilty. This really is the criminal justice system. So when a defendant gives up his or her trial rights in exchange for a promise, we are bargaining for what Mr. Trotter bargained for was this guideline recommendation from the government. The government breached that multiple times, and we cite cases where even one comment would be enough to breach a plea agreement. Someone can break a promise with just one statement, whether that's in law or in life, right? Just one statement can break a promise. Here we have multiple statements. The guidelines are a bubble that underrepresent the severity of the conduct. I would like to discuss a little bit prong three, Your Honors, because I think Kirkland and Malmquist give us kind of a unique take on prong three. It's not just a reasonable probability that the sentence was impacted. All we need to show with these sorts of aggressive breaches is that the sentence may have been impacted. And again, to as I was discussing with Judge Smith in Kirkland, even though the court didn't follow the government's recommendation, it still met prong three review and impacted the sentence because nothing in the record showed that the court would impose the same sentence without the breach. So that is our case here. The court did talk about a lot of the reasons it was relying on for the sentence, but none of those reasons show that it wasn't influenced by the government's really aggressive breach in this case.
One thing that your brief seems to say influenced the judge was the testimony of a victim, essentially. His son had died from fentanyl. What are you asking us to do something about that?
Your Honor,
or what what would be appropriate for district court to do?
Your Honor, I think it would be appropriate that the government not use that testimony to then kind of springboard its argument into an attack on the guidelines, which it did here.
So you're not suggesting that a district court ought to suppress or not hear that kind of victim testimony, are you?
I think the court can hear that if it would like to. Would I have objected? Perhaps if I were trial counsel, because the facts show this, the father really was, or the gentleman who overdosed and died was, I think, two transactions removed from Mr. Trotter, and he actually sadly passed away, I believe, 4 months after Mr. Trotter was already arrested and in pretrial detention. So, and everyone agreed that Mr. Trotter wasn't legally responsible for that death. I hope I'm answering your question.
Well, I guess my question is, victims seem to have almost a right to testify or say something at sentencing within bounds. I'm just asking, are you asking for specific relief or not? That was my main question.
I do think on remand it would be inappropriate for the government to use the testimony in the same manner to kind of springboard, you know, this gentleman asked for a life sentence. That shows how that is a helpful wake-up call for the court, which is what the government did here. Your Honors, I think if there are no further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time back to the court. But in conclusion, as in Williams, we're asking that the court vacate this judgment, remand to the trial court where Mr. Trotter can elect to either withdraw this plea altogether or seek specific performance in front of a new district judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hester. You've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Locker?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. It's an uncomfortable and difficult position to be here this morning to defend my sentencing argument. There are certainly parts of it that I regret the way that I phrased it. I regret its lack of clarity as to what I meant. That's also why I'm here and not one of my colleagues, not some other counsel on behalf of the government. Because context matters. Context certainly matters in this case.
Well, you know, your brief, it seems like you're of two minds. One page, it sounds like the plea agreement is still in place. And the next page, well, we can ignore the plea agreement.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to explain what I meant. I regret that I was not more clear what I meant in my sentencing argument, but I do not believe my sentencing argument breached the plea agreement. I had no intention of casting aside the plea agreement. I believe.
Well, what does, you know, you're not bound by the guidelines mean? You don't have to be bound. That doesn't sound like you're supporting an in-guideline sentence.
I'd like to turn directly to that phrasing then, Your Honor. The language in question specifically that's in question appears as follows. And for that reason, in the larger perspective, I see a mandatory minimum of 10 years and a statutory maximum of life. And although the guidelines, as calculated, are now 135 to 168, the court has full discretion. I believe those words are the ones that are most problematic in my argument, but those words are also 100% legally and factually true. And in fact, those words, in context, were an argument for an in-guideline sentence that I'd like to explain. From the beginning of that hearing and throughout the progression of that hearing, the trial court made it clear that it intended to sentence Mr. Trotter within the guidelines. The court announced at the beginning of the hearing that it accepted the plea agreement and that the sentence would be consistent with its terms. The court specifically said, the court now informs the defendant that the plea agreement is finally accepted and the judgment and sentence will be consistent with it. The court then announced that it intended to sentence the defendant within the guideline range and wanted to hear from the government where within the guidelines it believed the sentence should lie. The court said, Mr. Locker, I need to hear from you where you think the appropriate sentence lies, having had the guideline range resolved to 135 to 168 months. I interpret that to mean, and I think everyone in the courtroom would have interpreted that to mean, that he is announcing that he wants to hear where within those guidelines the appropriate sentence lies. And then the court asked both parties whether we were seeking an upward departure variance, and we announced explicitly that we were not. So I believe everyone in the courtroom believed that the parameters were set. You know the range of possible sentences, and this will be a guideline sentence. And so any argument thereafter has to be placed within that context. So what does my argument mean when I say the guidelines are too low? That is an argument for a high end of guideline sentence. I have a fundamental disagreement with Mr. Hester about his argument that arguing that the guidelines underrepresent conduct is a call for a sentence outside the guidelines. I believe that's a fundamental fallacy that's baked into his argument at every stage. If the guidelines are too low, that's not necessarily an argument for a sentence outside the guidelines. It's an argument that if the government believes that the sentence, that the guidelines are too low, it's essentially saying that the guidelines have already lessened the sentencing exposure of a defendant, and therefore the court should not consider the bottom end of the guideline range because we don't want the court to compound the error with the guidelines by considering a sentence at the bottom of the range. And that's what I meant. Because when I asked the court to consider the larger context, I immediately before those statements, I asked the court to consider the 3553 statement.
It seems to me your argument is very close to compounding your error.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Your argument today is close to compounding your error in this case.
Your Honor, I understand why the court may see that. If I may continue to explain, I genuinely believe that asking the court to consider the fact that the guidelines may be too low and underrepresent conduct is in no way an argument for an above-guideline sentence. And specifically, I'd like to point to my sentencing memorandum. Because in my sentencing memorandum that I filed before the sentencing hearing, I asked for an in-guideline sentence. And I made the exact same arguments. The exact same arguments in the sentencing memorandum, and they were as follows. First, that the guidelines are too low to reflect the seriousness of the conduct. Second, that the guidelines are too restrictive regarding death causation. And third, that the guidelines inadequately accounted for drugs known to be sold by Mr. Trotter, but not seized during the investigation. And all three of those arguments were made in support of a clear and explicit request for an in-guideline sentence.
So do you have it before you? Can you read us where you specifically asked for a... Yeah, that's okay. You can get your papers.
Yes,
I'm not questioning the validity of what you just said, but it would be helpful if you could just read that to us.
I'd be happy to.
This is your sentencing memorandum.
This is my sentencing memorandum, Your Honor. The court should sentence Trotter to somewhere in the upper half of the recommended guideline range. The government's recommendation differs from probation's recommendation for a bottom of the range sentence because it's the government's position that the PSR gives too little weight to the deadly consequences of Trotter's actions. The PSR finds that there is no victim impact, despite acknowledging that Trotter was the supplier of deadly fentanyl pills to Lewis, whose pills likely killed DS. Although the government agrees that the clarity of the causal chain is insufficient to have held Trotter directly responsible for DS's death, indeed, the government did not insist that Trotter or Lewis plead to an offense acknowledging the causation of death. However, this is not a victimless crime. Trotter was a high-volume dealer of deadly pills, and victims, in fact, died. Trotter should not be absolved of the tragedy of DS's death simply because he was two steps above the person who sold DS the lethal pills in the supply chain. To do so turns on its head our general paradigm for determining relative culpability in drug supply chains. Distributors higher in the supply chain are more responsible, not less. And I go on to make the same arguments that I made at the sentencing hearing and explicitly stated again at the end. Accordingly, this court should sentence Trotter to 151 to 168 months incarceration.
That was at the hearing. What you just read?
What I just read was my sentencing memorandum, which I previously
All right.
The point I think
that was before the oral part, where you said the guidelines aren't binding on the court.
Your Honor, I beg to differ. I made a nuanced argument that I believe the guidelines do underrepresent the conduct.
I think Judge Richmond's question, as I understand it, was that the last sentence that you read to us was from the sentencing memorandum, not from what was said in open court.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the sentencing memorandum is important for two reasons. First, it demonstrates that there is nothing inconsistent, incongruent, or hypocritical about stating that the guidelines underrepresent conduct in support of the recommendation for an in-guideline sentence. And second of all, the second point is that if these arguments are so offensive and so egregious and so such obvious breaches of the plea agreement, why has the appellant not complained about the sentencing memorandum? Because I made the same arguments in the sentencing memorandum.
Did your sentencing memorandum say the guidelines are not binding on the court?
No, Your Honor.
Your brief was puzzling to me also, because you talked about the defendant materially breaching, and you say that that removed restraints on you, and you bring in all the conduct that the government explicitly agreed would not be charged. And I had a hard time understanding. Are you saying, is there a plea agreement or is there not? And does his breach give you more leeway in your arguments in front of the court or not?
Your Honor, if I may, if I may point to a portion of the transcript during the sentencing hearing, where when the trial court asked me whether or not we would object, whether the government would object to his withdrawal of his objections, I indicated to the court, no, Your Honor, parties should be free to pivot and reconsider their position strategically with the court. However, the fact that those objections were made should be taken into account by the court in considering what kind of defendant it is dealing with under the 3553 factors, not in terms of whether or not the defendant...
I'm talking about your brief to us.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I'm talking about your brief to us in this court. You cite cases to say if a defendant materially breaches his commitments under the plea agreement, the government is released from its obligations under that compact. Now, do you think there was still an agreement or not?
I believe, Your Honor, that the government could have withdrawn from the plea agreement at that time.
Why are you talking, was there an agreement or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then why are you talking to us about his material breach?
Because
And that releases you somehow.
We chose to remain within the plea agreement, and because of that, he should receive the benefit of that plea agreement. So I don't believe that we are released from any obligations under it, but I do think it's a relevant factor when the court was considering under the 3553 factors what kind of defendant they were dealing with. I'd like to address Mr. Hester's complaint about my comment about guideline myopia, because I think this goes to the core of his argument, that somehow arguing that the guidelines underrepresent conduct...
You're saying you're almost ending sentence to us, at the end of your brief, the court may compare, this is to us, the government's ambiguous breach of the plea agreement with Trotter's blatant unpunished breaches. Now, are you saying the agreement is over and we should just compare what happened and what the sentence was chosen or not? I don't understand what your position was.
I think that's an equitable consideration. I don't think that, I believe we're still bound by the plea agreement, and I do believe we honored it. I'd like to turn to the third and fourth prongs, Your Honors. Should the court find that there was a breach, I don't believe that it was clear and obvious. I think that this discussion about the contextual nuance demonstrates that there's at least a reasonable disagreement. But should the court find that there was a breach, I don't believe it affected the outcome. The appellant cites Kirkland, but Kirkland is a case where the government conceded error and the government argued explicitly outside the plea agreement. This is a situation where under the third and fourth prongs here, there were significant and obvious reasons for the court to sentence Mr. Trotter at the high end of the guideline range, even if the government had made no argument at all at sentencing. And in fact, I would point to factors that Judge Schrader at the sentencing hearing pointed out himself on the record. He made no reference to the government's sentencing argument. It did make reference to the government's sentencing memorandum. First, Mr. Trotter avoided culpability for thousands of fentanyl pills that were not reflected in the guideline calculations. Judge Schrader mentioned multiple times that this was a long conspiracy, it involved lots of drugs, and it affected many lives. Judge Schrader mentioned that Mr. Trotter was the sole source of supply for a major fentanyl distributor. Judge Schrader also mentioned that firearms involved, and he mentioned this multiple times, that it affected his view of sentencing. Mr. Trotter was already convicted felon, and that he should not have guns. And this was also mentioned by the trial judge. There was also a child present in the home when the 4,900 fentanyl pills were seized at the time of the search warrant execution. Mr. Trotter had already received a considerable benefit from the government because the government had dropped a count of 18 U.S.C. 924C, which would have increased his sentence by 60 months as part of the plea bargaining process. And then also there's Mr. Sewell's testimony, which I believe was genuinely moving, which the government did not call Mr. Sewell as a witness. I acknowledged him as a victim, and he had told me before the hearing that he wished to address the court, and so I simply referred the court to him. The court asked me if there were any victims present. I said yes, and he does wish to address the court, which was the context of Mr. Sewell's presentation for
let me interrupt you just to focus on what you just said about the additional 60 months. So that was part of the plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we were to remand and give the option to withdraw the agreement, then that 60 months would be back on the table. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It would re-expose Mr. Trotter to an additional consecutive sentence of 60 months on top of the sentence for which he would receive on the underlying count. And so for all of those reasons stated, the sentencing court had significant reasons to sentence Mr. Trotter to the high end of the guideline range, independent of any argument from either party.
Kirkland says this: unless the record indicates that the district court would have imposed the same sentence regardless of the government's breach, the breach affects an appellate's substantial rights. Now, where in the record can you point to that say, the record shows that the district court would have imposed the same sentence regardless of a breach?
Your Honor, I would point to the record in pages 426 and 427, where the court cites numerous factors. Quote, I reviewed the sentencing memorandum that the government has filed, and I appreciate what you had to say. He has a prior conviction. This offense involves selling counterfeit oxycodone pills, which were laced with fentanyl. And he walked through each of the factors that I just cited as the reason for his sentence, particularly on page 427 of the appellate record. So at the end of the day, I think based upon all these factors, the fact that the defendant was and would be responsible for such a large amount of drugs for such a long period of time involving, you know, a fairly sophisticated conspiracy, I do think a sentence on the high end of the range is what is appropriate here, and that's where I intend to sentence him. So I think the court indicated that its reasons were based on the facts that were presented to it.
Well, doesn't every district court do that in every sentencing case on the record? Go through the. How does that tell us that the particular sentence he chose was unaffected by your argument that the guidelines aren't binding and they're too low in the first place?
Well, Your Honor, Judge Schrader did not have a savings phrase in there. He did not make an announcement, this is the same sentence I would impose apart from the guidelines or apart from argument. He did not make such a statement. But he did have multiple pages of the record where he discussed the exact reasons as to why he sentenced Mr. Trotter to where he did, and none of them make reference to the government's sentencing argument.
I thought he said your arguments were helpful.
Well, he said, I appreciate the government's remarks, but he said that on the heels of his discussion of my sentencing memorandum. And so I took that to mean that he was referring to the sentencing memorandum.
Well, he said he was referring to the sentencing memorandum, did he not?
It's in the same sentence. It's the second part of that sentence. I've reviewed the government sentencing memorandum. I appreciate what you had to say. And I took that, the statement, I appreciate what you had to say in reference to the written memorandum, not the argument present in that courtroom that day. Regarding the fourth prong, Your Honors, I believe there's nothing in this case that seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of these judicial proceedings. Mr. Trotter bargained for and received an in-guideline sentence. On its face, there's nothing in this scenario that besmirches the reputation, the public reputation of these proceedings. And I'd also point to the court to United States versus Hebron, which is cited by the appellant, and that holds up the standard that the appellant has an obligation to show that there's a reasonable probability that but for the error, he would have received a lesser sentence. I don't believe he can demonstrate that. He also, appellant can show, cite no cases where the government's breach has to be inferred or implied based on a cold reading of the record. In every single case that's cited by the appellant, the government's breach was explicit. Particularly in Kirkland, the government conceded that it breached. It had bargained, it had agreed to recommend a bottom of the guideline sentence, and it argued explicitly for 327 months, which was the top of the range. The appellant can cite no cases where it has to be inferred from context. And I believe the context, what I was trying to tell the court is that if the guidelines are the down markers on a larger playing field, and the guidelines are already overlaid in the wrong part of the playing field, I don't want the court to consider the furthest part of those down markers away from what I believe is the right position. That's not the same thing as asking for an outside the guideline sentence. And so that's where I regret my lack of clarity. I do recognize
we appreciate your candor on that. If we should decide that the agreement was breached, I'm not suggesting whether we will or won't, but if we decide that the agreement is breached, is it mandatory under the Williams case or any other authority that this be assigned to a different district judge? Do we have any latitude on that, or does Williams, as Fifth Circuit public precedent, require that?
I don't think it requires it. I think it can go back.
I went back and read Williams, and it just seems to be, you know, an unequivocal statement. But that's why I'm asking you what the government's position is on that.
I don't believe it's required. I think that is the result we see, but I don't think it's one that's required by its holdings.
Okay.
If I may take a moment to further explain my argument regarding the comments regarding guideline myopia, I believe this is, guideline myopia is the fallacy of treating the guidelines once set as being both the high and low watermarks for a particular set of conduct. And if that's the case, once you start to see it that way, you now have to see Mr. Trotter as being the most egregious form of a category of a level 33 offense level and a category 1 criminal history in order to receive a 168-month sentence. And I was asking the court specifically to expand its consideration, including the 3553 factors, in determining the appropriate sentence. But it was not an argument outside the guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Lockery.
Thank you.
Mr. Hester for rebuttal. So if we should agree with you and vacate the sentence and remand, you heard the discussion about what I call the additional 60-month provision. If you should decide not to go along with the plea agreement, do you agree that 60 months is back on the table?
It's that clean slate, square one. Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Of course, he could have liked for specific performance of this plea agreement to a new judge, then it would still be dismissed. Your Honors, I heard, and I appreciate Mr. Walker being here, and we're not saying anything he did was malicious or bad intent, and I heard him trying to explain his comments at sentencing in context and what he meant and what he genuinely believed by those comments. With all due respect, that is irrelevant. What he said in front of the district court is what matters, and what he said in the sentencing memo was all before he made these aggressive attacks on the guidelines at the sentencing hearing.
But then the district judge referred specifically to the government's sentencing memorandum.
Yes, Your Honor. So the court considered the sentencing memorandum. The court considered a lot of different things. And what Kirkland says is simply because the court exercises its discretion, which it must do in every case, that doesn't mean it wasn't influenced by the breach. And this was an explicit breach. I think no matter how Mr. Walker wants to phrase it, he agreed to a guideline range recommendation. You can't then come in and say the guidelines are a bubble and myopic and underrepresent the severity of the offense and still be asking for a guideline sentence.
Did he say, remind the court that the sentence is life and that the court has full discretion? Did he say that or not?
He did, right at the very end. And he also used the phrase at least twice, step back from the guideline range. We're asking that the court step back from the strictures of the guideline range, look at all the 3553A factors, and you have full discretion. By the way, the statutory maximum is life. Back to prong three, substantial rights. I think it's really important, and I didn't say this, I did say it in my brief, but didn't say it in my opening argument. The neutral party's recommendation in this case was bottom of the guidelines. Probation recommended to the court a bottom of the guideline sentence. Mr. Trotter was the lowest criminal history category available under the guidelines, criminal history category one. He also presented a character witness and some character letters that the court considered. So he had a lot of mitigating factors. He had the neutral party asking for bottom of the guidelines. He, of course, kept his agreement and asked for bottom of the guidelines.
So if you should achieve what you've referred to as specific performance, that would, of course, be to enforce the agreement, and in your view, the agreement would be a sentence within the guidelines. Is that right?
It's not that the sentence is within the guidelines, it's that the government requests that sentence, and that it's what he bargained for was that the government would come in and say the guidelines are an appropriate sentence here.
And consistent with that agreement, a new district judge, if that's what we decide, could still impose it at the top of the range, and in your view, that would not be a reversible error.
I think that's right, Your Honor. Yes. I mean, we would have a new sentencing hearing where the government doesn't make these same attacks on the guideline range and actually ask for a guideline sentence, which it didn't do in the actual sentencing hearing. I know it did in the sentencing memorandum, but when we got to the sentencing hearing, complete different tune, right? So we're saying give Mr. Trotter what he bargained for. That is a guideline recommendation from the government.
So again, and we keep assuming if we were to agree with you on the underlying issue, so if this went back on remand, is it only the defendant that has the right to withdraw from the agreement, or does the government also have that option?
It's only the defendant, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you for your time. I see my time has expired. Again, we're asking that the court vacate the judgment and remand to the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hester. Your case is under submission, and we noticed that you're court appointed, and the court wishes to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment, and we appreciate your good work on behalf of your client.
Thank you.
Remaining case for today, Campuzano versus Bondi.